June 19th, 2020. Got a great guest today in Ray Hartman, and we don't talk a lot about politics. We touched a little bit about Missouri's journalism school, what it was like in the early 70s, journalism overall for that matter in that time. Personally, I was a little bit more interested in how he created the RFT and in one of the top 10 alternative newspapers in the country. Great behind-the-scenes stuff. More on that in a second. On June 25th, Missouri reported its highest number of new COVID cases at 553 people. June 25th, 553 positive cases. Last week, we averaged 731. No doubt about it, we're getting more testing done. If I'm trying to look at it apples to apples, in May, 3.6% of tests were positive. Last week, almost double, 6.8% were positive. As of Saturday, 1,130 people have died from the disease. Some good news, hospital admissions continue to hover around 30 a day. Friend of the show, Jim Thomas, is off to quarantine in Edmonton with the Blues, slated for a August 2nd opener against Colorado. I'm not sure how happy I'd be about that if I was Jim. Speaking of another friend of the show, congrats to last week's guest, Guy Phillips, new grandpa of 9-pound, 13-ounce Van Moulton. Is that a great name or what? When we talk next, the Cardinals should have opened up their season on Friday. For the weekend against the Pirates, just over 100 tickets will be sold for the Broadway Brewhouse Bud Deck. Say that five times fast. Can't buy just one ticket. Got to be at least two or four or more. It'll run you $100, maybe $150, and that does include some kind of a food beverage package. MLS expansion. See you in 2023. Maybe some stadium tours to pass the time. Side note, if you have not, would appreciate you hitting the subscribe button wherever you are hearing this. Helps me get in front of more ears. You can do the same on our YouTube channel, OT with Oliver. After this podcast with Ray, we filmed a St. Louis 7, where I asked him 7 questions only a St. Louisan can answer. He had a great Balaban story. Ray's episode is right next to Guys, Art Holliday, Rainey Carricker, and others. 3 things you should if you have not. We lost a great one in civil rights advocate John Lewis this week. As we look forward to how we should be teaching our children moving forward, this man needs a more prominent place. On Netflix, David Letterman has a show, My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. His first guest was President Obama. Featured in it was Congressman Lewis walking over the bridge in Selma. There's better, longer stuff out there, but if this had not hit your radar, take the 5 minutes. Number 2, my eldest Rebecca came home recently around my wife's birthday. She had never seen an Alfred Hitchcock movie, so we saw The Birds, Psycho, and Vertigo. I have for a long time voiced how I felt Psycho was overrated, and I was WRONG. If you haven't, see it or re-see it. Vertigo, by the way, for a movie released in 1958, has about as little dialogue as most FX series shows do now. Jimmy Stewart could do more with a look than anybody. Lastly, been a while since you've picked up an RFT or watched Donnybrook on Channel 9? You're missing out. As I mentioned, growing up in the 80s and 90s, the RFT was the bomb. It broke a lot of stories, gave the alternative lifestyle people a louder voice, and I think its story has been somewhat lost over time, and that's a shame. At the end, we do talk about the upcoming elections, but thanks, Ray, for letting me indulge on your accomplishments. I think folks needed a place to learn about the RFT, and now they do. Our town's John Stewart, Ray Hartman.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
And welcome back for another episode of Overtime with Oliver. Today, we are excited to have Ray Hartman on, 40-plus year veteran of St. Louis media. Nice job. 40 years, man. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Oliver. And I know you're a fellow alum of Mizzou, right?
Absolutely.
I think you came, I was a little ahead of you. They had finished, I think it was the third column had been built when I was there. but yeah, M-I-Z.
Z-O-U. So like, my mom texts me last night, right? And she's like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? I was like, hey, I'm actually going to knock out an interview with Ray Hartman podcast, if it works out. And she texts me, and I don't know if you can see it, but she texts me and she says, tell him I like his essays and that we need him on Donnybrook.
Well, I've been there for 33 years, and unless they tell me otherwise, I'll be there tomorrow night.
You grew up in St. Louis.
I did. I fought my way off the streets of Creve Coeur.
What'd your folks do?
My dad was a vice president for Chenoweth Chapman Cleaners, a big in those days. I think the second largest dry cleaners in St. Louis. And back in the days when people had their clothes delivered, and I grew up riding the truck, and he was an executive, but he did everything and taught me a little humility. I spent one summer bagging clothes all summer when I was like 16. And every time I see a plastic clothing bag, I cringe because it was warm. And as the boss's son, I got zero special treatment. So it was, got some humility out of that. My mom was just a stay-at-home mom, and they passed away a long time ago, but I was very lucky. My childhood went great.
Do you have a favorite Sportsman's Park story?
I do. I say favorite. The fact that I have a Sportsman's Park story and that I'm old enough to have one is a source of great distress to me. But having said that, I do have, as bad as my memory is, as bad, I don't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. I do remember seeing Stan Musial hit one over the right field pavilion. I'm pretty sure it was the last year of Sportsman's Park. I'm not positive. It would have been 63. I would have been 11 years old. And I just remember that. It's kind of a fun childhood memory. And I also remember being in the stands the first year that the Blues went to the Stanley Cup against Montreal. And I think that was 68.
From the mean streets of Crèvecœur, you went to Parkway Central.
I did. I went there. And then I went to Mizzou.
Parkway Central's Colts, right?
Correct. Actually, when I went to Parkway Central, it was just Parkway. Again, I don't know if the whole theme tonight is like talking to the elderly, but when I went to Parkway as a sophomore, Parkway West, which is now known as a very old high school, was being built. And so we went to split sessions my sophomore year. I think that's when I learned not to want to wake up early, because I think I was in the afternoon sessions. I think we went to like noon. There were so many kids. It was just Parkway then, and because West was under construction. But that was just one year where we split sessions my sophomore year in 68, I think it was.
I'm guessing Central did not have metal detectors at the time.
It did not. Interestingly, it had, even after the split sessions, forget about that. When I graduated, the year I graduated, there were 2,200 kids in three grades at Parkway, Parkway Central. And I had a tour given to me a few years ago out there by the superintendent. And it was a big school. I want to say it is three times as large physically now as it was then. It's just unbelievable to see how large a facility they have now. And they have a swimming pool and all this kind of stuff. And it's three times larger. And they had, I think he told me they had 1,300 students. So you think about it, they have about 60% of the students now in three times space. And it was a nice school. I mean, it was good.
And you were a member of the Parkway High School Hall of Fame.
Yeah, which is very nice of them. It's a nice honor. I right there alongside of Eric Greitens, who came along after me. But it's nice that they have that, and it's a good fundraiser for the school. I always kind of, it's nice. First of all, when you start getting into halls of fame, it's nice, but it also, again, gives you that kind of, that people are starting to view you sort of archaeologically. it's nice.
So like myself, we are both graduates of the greatest journalism school in the country. Yes. You go down to Mizzou. Here's how much you've got it together compared to me. You go down to Mizzou, first thing you do is you publish your own newspaper for a couple semesters. And then you move over to the Maneater, and you're the only person before or since who has served four semesters as the editor. Walk me through that.
Well, it didn't quite have that. First of all, one of the things, and I stole this line from Jack Buck with his knowledge, is because it's actually true in my case at Mizzou, is that I graduated in the half of the class that made the top half possible. I ended up with like a 2.6 cum, and I think you have to have a 3 to get in now. So there was that. So I went down to Mizzou in 1970. I was a very conservative kid, by the way, but that lasted about 20 minutes, and then I was a liberal kid. It's what you do when you're 18 years old and getting away from school for the first time. But I actually was on the Maneater staff in the fall of 70, and I was on the sports and the news staff, which was kind of a strange story. But it there was an activities mark that year, and I was working the booth. They had just promoted me to news editor. They were very nice. But for some reason, being 18, I was mad about something. I don't know what I was mad about. I literally don't remember, but I don't even know if I say mad, but for whatever possessed me, I went over to this booth, and it was like a group of young Republicans, I think, that were forming an alternative to the Maneater, that they felt it was one-sided, which it arguably was. We were kind of liberal and stuff. And I wasn't particularly, I wasn't Republican or conservative at that point. I was sort of metamorphosizing. But they saw that I was, so I applied, I think it was sort of half jokingly, to be news editor of this newspaper, because that's what I was. And when they saw that they had the news editor, the Maneater, they immediately elevated me to the editor and picked me, because I guess, by default or something, and handed me 50 applications that they had for people. And thus was born the Campus Courier as an answer to the Maneater. And we did that for 9 months. My parents had a little tiny, there's a few grand put away for me, which I blew in the first 9 months, publishing what was a very feisty, kind of a nice, I don't know, it was just a silly little campus newspaper. Didn't really have any politics or anything. I don't know if they were looking for Republican politics. It was a little more even-handed maybe than the Maneater. I don't remember. But anyway, I, of course, ran out of money. And in December of that year, which would have now been after my first semester as a freshman, I decided I couldn't keep doing this. I'll apply to be Maneater editor, because that's, committee picks that. And I got chosen. And then I did that for 2 semesters. And I was really an activist. By then, we were fighting with the J school about everything. We were too late really to protest Vietnam. So we were just kind of like, angry activists in search of a cause. We really didn't have anything to protest. So we talked about like student power and student involvement. And I actually still believe some of this stuff. I haven't had really that much emotional growth since then. And, but I ended up running for a second term, which nobody had ever done. And I think after they picked me to do that, they realized that was a mistake. And so they passed term limits. So yeah, I did 4 semesters of the Maneater, preceded by 2 of the Campus Courier. So 6 out of 8 semesters, I spent probably 80 hours a week working on a campus paper. And I don't try this at home. I mean, I do have a bias toward people. I should say did when I owned the Riverfront Times and so forth. I always had a soft spot for people who not only went to our alma mater, but also for people that got involved in the Maneater, got involved in the student press, because I thought that was a good sign.
So for people who don't know, and this is a question that can go a whole lot of different ways, but when it comes to the paper, how long did it take you to put it together? The other is, you could not make changes after this hour. And now that's not the case.
Well, it was all photo type setting, and it was just there was no technology. I mean, compared to the technology that existed back then, I don't remember any particular length of time, but it was all done with actually the innovation in those days was cold type instead of hot type, from linotypes machines and stuff. But actually the issue we had was that the dean of the journalism school, who's no longer living, Roy Fisher, and we were not pals, and he wanted to take over the Maneater. He wanted the J school to run the Maneater, and his devious plot in our eyes was to control the typesetting. And we decided to get our own typesetting equipment, and we did, which was not that big an investment, but it kept us independent of the J school, which I will say, if you want to give me credit for anything, had I not been willing to fight with the J school back then and make the Maneater self-sufficient, it would just be part of the, it would just be a product of the J school. And I don't even know if that's good, because I think it's good, but I'm a little less of a booster than you are of the J school, but I I do think it's one. I certainly recommend people going there.
Where was your favorite place to grab a burger in Colombia?
Was it would have been Harpo's, maybe?
Sure.
I think Harpo's.
No wrong answers here, Ray.
No, well, no, I'm just saying, again, most of the people aren't alive. I don't remember. I remember, wasn't Harpo's? I think that was one of our places.
Absolutely.
And I'm trying to think where else we hung out. There were several places, but they've been, the donut shop was really where I hung out on Broadway. A friend of mine would hang out and we'd, you know, solve the world's problems to like 3 a.m. at the nut shop, we called it, on Broadway. I don't know if it's still there. But because we weren't old enough to go to the bars when I was there. And so I really didn't do much bar hopping, which isn't to say I didn't do disreputable things, but I didn't really go to bars. But like, I think Harpo's probably would have been the place.
You were the only student at Mizzou who did not have a fake ID?
I didn't. But yeah, as I say, we had discovered smoking pot at that point, which I had never done in high school. So that had that had to suffice.
Only so many allowed vices, right?
And I didn't, you know, I was never into anything very substantial, but I mean, you know, at that time, you know, that was sort of the, you know, our rebellion, as it were.
So did you graduate from Mizzou and you went to New York to be a reporter?
Yeah, I thought I had, you know, when I was graduating, you can understand I had spent 6 of the previous 8 semesters as a college editor, which was unusual. And I had been an intern at the Philadelphia Inquirer one summer, which is a pretty good, was one of the better internships. I was a stringer for the Post-Dispatch, believe it or not. I only did one story, but it got a curator kicked off the board of curators. So it was kind of fun. So I had a lot, and I had been a copy boy working for my friend, dear departed friend Martin Dugan at the Globe Democrat. So I had a pretty good resume compared to most kids. And I figured, well, I'll just send out 20 form letters. And I literally went to the Almanac or whatever and got the top 20 circulation newspapers in the country and let the bidding war start for my services. And I might have gotten two or three form letters back. That's the best I got out of it. Most of them didn't even bother. And I remember one from the Boston Globe was, "We're sorry, we're not hiring people with no experience," which kind of hurt my feelings. But I ended up doing a road trip because I did 20 newsrooms in 15 cities in 12 days. Back in those days, Allegheny, I think we called it Agony, Airlines had a special deal that you could buy a system pass, and it was like a couple $100 or something, it wasn't much, where you could fly for a week in their entire system for free. You know, and again, keep in mind, this is before TSA and all that. You just got a pass and you could just fly for a week. And I did. I ended up going to all these cities, and that's how I ended up in Albany. I mean, I'll give you all the details of the trip. When I walked into newsroom at Albany, the guy, great guy, sadly died now, Jack Pease, was the managing editor, and he looks at me, here I am, a kid from St. Louis, and he goes, so I give him my resume, I have my little briefcase and my clips, and he says, "You got family here?" I go, "No." He says, "You visiting?" "No." He says, "How long are you in town?" And I said, I looked at my watch, said, 2 hours, and he picked up on the trip, and I think I got hired more as a novelty than on any qualifications. I ended up getting 4 job offers, believe it or not, out of that trip at a time when it was a real dry year. So that's how I ended up at Albany.
And what was the name of the paper?
Albany Knickerbocker News, one of the many newspapers in the country that was, died, sadly, and so many of them are. Actually, it was 2 papers then. It was the Times Union and the Albany Nick News, and I'm not making this up. I walked up to the door and flipped the coin. So I went to the Nick News. Turns out the Nick News was a real liberal paper, and the Times Union was a real conservative paper. And the only reason I ended up at the liberal one was because of a coin toss, because I didn't know anything about it.
How did you end up writing speeches for Republican Kit Bond?
Well, I had the opportunity. A friend of mine was leaving the office, dear friend, from Mizzou, Chip Castile. He was leaving to go back to law school. and he recommended me for the job. And my parents had passed away by then. I was an only child. My grandma lived in St. Louis, and I really wanted to, there was a real attraction to being closer to her and to me. And so I hadn't planned on leaving. In fact, they had just put me on the state capitol beat, which was really kind of cool after 14 months. I wasn't really that good. I was okay. I was a good, decent reporter. I think I was a good reporter, actually. I just didn't really like it. You know what I mean? I just didn't like it. I don't know, for whatever reason. But I always assumed that if somebody recommended you for a job like that, you know, you got the job. Well, it turns out, not in Kit Bond's case. Kit Bond, it was all about, he's all about integrity. It was all about merit. And Kit interviewed me, and I still think he was, if not the best, one of the best governors in Missouri history. And I say that even though I disagreed with him greatly in the views he ended up having as a senator, but he's really one of the best people, you know, I've ever known. But Kit, you know, instead of like just giving me the job, he gave me three assignments. He gave me like a test speech to write, a test, I don't know, state of the state, you know, whatever they were, three test little assignments. And I mean, I am the worst procrastinator in history. You know, in fact, my son will say to me, you know, he says, I think I said something to him about like, can we talk about, he wanted to say, can we talk about procrastination? I told him, let's wait till tomorrow. But I really am bad about that. So I did, and you had mentioned my college career, you know, with this. One of the features I didn't mention was all-nighters. We pulled probably, I'm not exaggerating, probably 200 all-nighters in 4 years. That's how we did. You know, when you're young, that's how you do it. And so rather than go back to Albany and not get this done, I had an ex-girlfriend that I was still friends with. And I think I was staying with her, and I stayed up all night. And the next morning he had the three assignments on his desk. And much like I got the job in Albany because it was so, you know, freaky that a guy would just show up for 2 hours, I think that may have got me the job. I don't know if it was because they were any good or because he was like, well, that was fast. Interviewed him at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at 8 a.m. Here's your answer. It's like, this guy can do this. And I, you know, who knows if it was because I was any good. I will say this. I did well enough for him as a speechwriter. That was 75. That by the end of 76, we were returning to the private sector. So I don't think I deserve full blame for the fact that we lost to Joe Teasdale, but I helped.
Did you like the show West Wing?
Yeah, I never really got into it. I should have, because I like the idea of it. I've seen a few episodes, but I never just sort of binged on it or anything.
So there's a arc in the show where Rob Lowe plays this character who is the writer for the president, right?
Right.
In one episode, somebody does something horrible, doesn't sign their name to it, and Seaborn goes nuts and says, you sign your name to everything.
Right.
So my question to you is, the people writing Trump's speeches now, are they signing their name on the bottom of those speeches?
I have no idea. I will tell you this. It's really strange to me to even imagine what goes on, not only in Washington, but Jeff City, because Kit, as a governor, was there at a time when the Democratic Party had a stranglehold, really the whole last half of the century, really almost the entire century in Missouri. Missouri was a completely Democratic, kind of Dixiecrat Democratic state. And Kit was elected, along with Jack Danforth and some others, really the two of them, to reform state government. They were the reformers. They were the, you know, in fact, when I wrote speeches from him, it was based on stuff he did in 73 about, that's when Missouri got its first open meeting sunshine laws, first public counsel's office, a consumer affairs department, you know, all these campaign finance, all kinds of reforms. That was what he was about. And see, he was all about doing things completely by the book. I wasn't even allowed to write speeches that would be used at campaign events. It was church and state. The campaign was separate from the office. And it is so different. It's really unfair to compare it to the presidential thing. I mean, Trump is what he is. But just under Greitens, the unbelievable lack of separation between the political side and the governmental side was so astonishing to me, because that's apples and apples. And I can't really say that about Parson because I don't know much about him, but with Greitens, it was just unbelievable. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a different world, really. I mean, and you know, as I say, over his career, I disagreed with Kit on issues because he became more conservative as a senator. But boy, there were never any integrity issues back then.
You mentioned Martin Dugan. He gave you your first job.
He did. Well, one of them. I ushered it. I think I mentioned to you, I bagged clothes and a dry cleaner for my dad. I was an usher at Cardinal games, and I was copy boy at the Globe Democrat. Kind of all, one year I did all three, I think. And just obviously all part-time. I didn't get to usher that many games. I did some. But I was copy boy, and I happened to report to Martin Dugan's secretary, who was one of the great ladies of all time, Florence Litwicki, and all these names. And Martin was very kind to me, and he remembers that I would come back. Remember, you know, Martin passed away, I guess, what, 3 or 4 years ago, one of my dearest friends ever. And he remembers me coming back when I was a kid at Mizzou just to visit and see how they were. And he thought that was cool. But I mean, he was really a wonderful, wonderful man. And he and I, again, rarely agreed on issues, but I'm sort of old school. I come from the days where Barry Goldwater and Hubert Humphreys were the two opposite, you know, icons, whatever you want to call them, leaders in the Senate, and they were also best friends. And in fact, you know, one of the things I did do before I came back here and started the Riverfront Times after we lost the election was I actually thought about going up and working for a senator in 76 when we lost. I did one quick tour and actually, Charles Percy, who was very nice to us at the time, he was a senator from Illinois. He hosted me for a day. And I do, you talk about memories, and again, I don't have that many. I got to see Humphrey and Goldwater kind of through a distance in the private Senate lunchroom having lunch together, which was kind of cool.
So you're all of 24, March 1977, and you start Hartman Publishing. Profile St. Louis.
Uh-huh. The idea was back then it was going to be a newsprint version combining People Magazine and Newsweek for St. Louis. It was going to have a little bit of news. It was going to have a lot. It's called Profile St. Louis. It was going to be about people and tell their stories. And I'm not sure what the heck I was thinking, but it did. It, you know, I did it. I had a little money. As I said, my parents died when I was 17 and 20, and I didn't have a huge inheritance, but they were good enough to me to leave me enough life insurance money that only took me about 6 months to go through it. Yeah, I started it when I was 24. I didn't know any better. And our first office is now the county jail. It was 110 South Central. And I'm happy to say I'm not in the county jail, but that was the site of our first office, a little three-story building that was raised to build the county jail.
Who came up with the name Riverfront Times?
I did. I don't want to bore you with all the details, but Profile St. Louis, everybody liked it. The first issue actually was the late, great Jack Carney, John's dad, gave me four. Not only did he give me generously of his time, but I wrote the cover story, and it was called The Most Familiar Unfamiliar Face in St. Louis. And Jack Carney wasn't big back then. He was gargantuan big. I mean, he had, I don't know what the numbers would have been, but like everybody listened to Jack Carney's show in St. Louis back then. I mean, keep in mind, we're pre-internet, we're pre-cable, we're pre-everything in 77. I mean, he had a four-hour show from 9 to 1. And I did the cover story, and I don't know, he told me that it was the best story ever written about him, which was quite flattering because he was kind of a big star. And he put me on the air for 4 hours with him talking about stuff, which was quite an honor, but anyway, and so people liked it. We did cover stories on famous people all the time. I did it myself. But the thing is, it just didn't make any sense economically. We were printing 10,000 newspapers, trying to sell them. That didn't work. It just was a disaster. I'm getting my hair cut downtown by a guy in November 70. We're actually in probably September of 7 that year. We're really on the ropes. And he says, you know, it's too bad you couldn't do something like this just for downtown. And a dim light bulb went off and thought, wait a minute, you know, why not? So I decided to try the idea of a quality, because it was quality, a quality newsprint product that would just be downtown. And I had by then convinced myself at the old age 25, now I had figured this out, that what you needed was saturation. So we drew a map, line on the map. It was at the time 12th Street, now known as Tucker to the West. It was Shodo to the south and Delmar, probably, maybe even Washington, probably Delmar to the north and then the riverfront. That was our little box. And we decided we'd print 20,000 newspapers about downtown and confine it to that little box. Now, this is back when downtown was a pretty, you know, it was vibrant. And, you know, there were two big, you know, major hub department stores, the famous Bard and then Styx, Bear and Fuller. It was a thriving downtown. And a funny thing happened. It worked. We did this first thing. And as far as Riverfront Times, there was a little newspaper that just printed press releases at the time, literally took them and verbatim just reprinted, like, you know, downtown St. Louis's press releases. And so we actually brought journalism. I think one of the first stories was the headache called Highway 40. It wasn't controversial, it wasn't political, but it was about telling people stories and also promoting restaurants and issues like traffic downtown or something. It wasn't anything like anything controversial. And people ate it up. And we just did it once. I wasn't even sure we were going to do it again. And I think we took a month off. We did it in November 77. And people ate it up because they had never seen anything like it. To tell you how, I don't know if you call it immature, we thought we wouldn't take press releases. We weren't reprinting them, but we wouldn't cover the library because it was on the other side of our box. It was west of 12th Street. We kind of got over that in a minute. But the point is, we were really intense on a little experiment, and it worked. The one thing it did, and it really informed me for the rest of publishing, was your job's to ring the cash registers of your advertiser. If you get results from them, you can make them mad, you can be controversial, you can say what you want, but you got to get results. You can't, and Profile St. Louis was just the opposite. It was, everybody liked it. It was soft. It was happy. It was positive, but it didn't get results because it was too spread out. So the fact that it got results for advertisers, even though it was just a downtown little lunch thing, there were no personal ads in it, by the way, back then. There was nothing like that. It became kind of famous for those later, but it was it. It worked. And then we tried it. I think we tried it 2 months later. It worked again. And then we made it. And then we finally gave up on Profile St. Louis in May of 78, the next year, and moved our offices in September. We actually published for about 3-4 months. Our only enterprise was a downtown newspaper published out of Clayton. And then we moved into the Syndicate Trust building. And after that, it grew. And then it turned into an alternative news weekly, which I like to describe as a college newspaper for the real world. And as you know, I had had a little experience with that. Because when I was at the back at Manny, we were feisty. We were activists. And so eventually the Riverfront Times, I ended up going to a conference in 70, in 80. I had just heard of this group of young, like 3-year-old group of alternative newsweeklies. And they, you know, I applied for a membership. There was only maybe 20 members and they rejected us. And the stated reason they rejected it was your paper sucks. Because it was just a downtown newspaper and they just said it sucks. I mean, it doesn't stand. So the next year we were very poor. My partner, Dick May, and I, had come in as a ploy, help me out a little bit, he and I drove to New Haven for the second conference and we got rejected again the second year for membership. They said, well, it doesn't suck as much as last year, but it's just, and then finally the third year in Portland, The third year. Now imagine, the Association of Alternative Newsweeklies had had five meetings, and we were at the, we had been four previous meetings as no good, or, and we had been rejected for membership at half of them. And we, I think they just were worn out. Kind of, again, seems to be a story of my life, you know, just like me showing up in Albany. They said, fine, you're in. No, but we were better by then. And we got accepted. And that's really what, that process starting in 1980 is when the Riverfront Times started to do stories about homeless. And I'm proud of all the stuff we did back then. We fought against the Gateway Mall, which was a horrible, bad project to which we're still paying to this day, tearing down three historic buildings and tearing up the middle of downtown. To this day, St. Louis is paying for that downtown. And we fought against it. We were the only ones. And what emerged from that was we were the only people who would take on the mainstream press. So that became our niche. And I'm proud of that. We really were responsible for cutting off a milk run of really millions of dollars in tourism money that was given to the VP Fair, the Vail Profit Organization. We did a lot of stuff back then. We were feisty. And those, I look back on those days as kind of the our glory days in a way. And so the paper grew and went through all kinds of stuff. We had, one of the things I had done before we, actually 79, I decided to try free personal ads because we had had those in Columbia and Maneater, and they became, they at one point were about a third of the publication. And we never said what they should be, but they turned out to be very, very sexual. And that sort of defined who we were for a long time. But the main ones that were controversial actually really were, and there were some stories about how we didn't know what we were doing. People were putting other people's phone numbers in there. I mean, it was just crazy. It was the Wild West, really. But the controversial ones were the gay men. we didn't discriminate back. You know, I'd been for gay lib since the 70s, and we weren't going to discriminate against gay people. And that was it was just the fact that we would publish clean ads where men wanted to meet other men was considered just obscene in the 1980s. And it was the biggest reason we couldn't, it really held us back advertising wise. But like I said, the reason we survived was we ran cash registers and there were enough people that didn't have that kind of baked in bigotry back then. People act like this was something we all have been agreeing on, like Martin Luther King or something. A lot of these things that we all agree on today, we didn't all agree on them. Okay. And that was one of them. I always got a kick out of the fact that nobody ever got mad about the lesbians. It was only the gay men. Yeah, we just weren't going to discriminate. You know, it wasn't like make a big deal out of it. But there was all that.
Did you ever meet Dan Savage?
I did not, but we published his work. Actually, it was toward the end. I don't know. I think we just started carrying Savage Love later on. I don't remember the timing. But I did. Well, I take it back. I did meet him once at a conference. I did meet him at one of our alternative Newsweekly conferences. I went on to become president of the association that had, they made me membership director immediately upon bringing me in because it was such a joke that I had been the admissions director, of the committee. I was in charge of admissions after when they finally let me in 82, they insisted that I be the chairman of the admissions committee because of my ability to empathize. I became president of it for a couple of years or so.
So on one hand, you're challenging the status quo. On the other hand, you really have a thing to promote local music. You took it upon yourself to promote the local music.
Yeah, that was just sort of organic. I mean, we were boomers. I mean, you understand something. We were the boomers. But that was, now today I'm still a boomer. And my kids, I have a 14 and a 16-year-old, which is unusual for someone of my age. But and they're my whole life, but they do refer to me as okay boomer on frequent occasions. But back then, the baby boomer was it. The boom, that's who everybody wanted. We did our first readership survey, I think it was in 80, and I was 28, and the average age of our reader was 28. Then 2 years later, we did a readership survey, and the average age of our reader was 30. And 2 years later, we did a third one. It was 32. So I was literally the median back then. The Riverfront Times was published by and for baby boomers who were not ridiculed as they are today, justifiably for their old age. We were the people that had everybody wanted, and we had them, and that's how. And so the bars, that's what we did. We went to bars. I mean, you know, you were talking about college. I didn't have a fake ID. We were living in a bar. I mean, I lived, and I was poor back then. We were living off happy hour food. I mean, you know, it was like, not poor really, but I mean, you know, not, you know, that's the wrong word, but we were, you know, yeah. I mean, dinner was happy hour every night, you know? And so that's who we were. So music, and understand, this is before the internet. And the Post-Dispatch did not, nowhere else. If you could imagine, and it's really crazy to think about this in my lifetime, or our lifetime even, in the 1980s, if you wanted to know where the live bands were playing in St. Louis, we were literally the only place you could find it. There was no other source of what bands were playing where, not any other source. Eventually, the Post-Dispatch figured it out by the early 90s and came up with this thing called Get Out to compete with us, which by then it was too late for him. But we literally, for our little golden period in the 1980s, and either the bars or the bands, you know, and it's so funny now, I get to, on KTRS, I have a show, and I do what I call the show with no name on Friday nights, which is an hour of comedy followed by an hour of music. And I've been able to feature people like David Surkamp, and Sarah Surkamp from Pavlov's Dog, which ended up being one of the great prog rock bands in St. Louis history and toured the world. We promoted them, did an interview recently with Steve Ems from The Urge, we were a major promoter of The Urge.
Steve Ewing.
Again, Steve Ewing is what I meant to say. Sorry about that. Steve Ewing is who I talked to from the Urge, and Steve has his own band now, and the Urge. But the Urge was went to be a great band, and we were their early promoters. Yeah, so we really, and I have to say, I deserve zero credit for that. I didn't know music, and we had a couple of young writers, Richard Byrne and Thomas Crone, who were just amazing. And really, and some others who really understood music. They knew the scene, they were part of it, they loved it, and they were experts on it. And the music, the things that built the RFT were, besides the personals for readership, was the function of the calendar and the information, the work of those guys, and Cliff Fralick in film, who'd gone on to run Cinema St. Louis. We had the best film reviewers, led by Cliff. We had the best music. And then there was the political element, and I wrote my column, and we were activists. I mean, so we had a really nice mix of things. We had activist politics, really more about questioning authority. We were obviously liberal and considered radical. Although I will tell you this, the woke people today think I'm Rip Van Winkle. Okay, so we weren't, I got picked by our readers as the best radical every year, but we weren't as radical. You know, we were definitely to the left, but I mean, we were pro-choice and pro-gay rights, and you know, et cetera, but we were not, you know, we were environmentalists, but we, you know, and we did some great stories. Byron Clements, who's still around, did a great story on, we did the first story on the tragedy of Coldwater Creek. We did it in the early 80s. Can you imagine that, like 81, 82, Byron Clements, who unfortunately his family grew up in that, persuaded me. Byron's always been a little to the left of me, but it was to his credit that we did those stories. So, I mean, we rocked it in the 80s and 90s. We really did. We had a good time, and I think we did a lot for St. Louis. And I'm proud of those days. I mean, you know, as I say, I've gone on to, you know, mess up enough afterwards. But I have to say, I look back on those days real fondly.
Were you part of the group that saved Union Station?
No, I wouldn't say we saved it. I mean, we were for preservationists. We were preservationists. So we were in favor of any preservation. And we were certainly we did events at Union Station when it was, if you mean by that, and a dear friend of mine, Brian Uleone, who's passed away, was general manager. We did a lot with them, and we were certainly part of it. I'm sure we were there at the opening. But I mean, I wouldn't say we saved. I mean, we were part of saving anything, but yeah, I can't take credit for that. But yeah, we were always, of course, now my friend Bob O'Loughlin's doing amazing things with the aquarium and the whole, he's really turned it around in amazing ways. But, and I think Union Station is a good example. And today, Bob, of what we should be doing in this town, which is appreciating and never taking for granted our history. I mean, it isn't, you know, Roman history or Greek history, but we have some great heritage here. And I am, if I have a knee-jerk issue today, it's preserving things rather than tearing them down. And it's not just the old stuff. I thought one of the most awful stories that nobody else besides me recently would even talk about was the fact that the library board decided to tear down the Library of Lindbergh, which, while it's not some gorgeous, you know, famous building, was a very solid example of that architecture of the 50s and 60s. There's absolutely no justification for tearing it down. When renovation's almost always a better example, idea, preservation. And in the county, nobody wanted to talk about it. I mean, literally, it just got railroaded through. And it was horrible. So yeah, I mean, I still, and again, I'm a preservationist and, you know, other causes like that.
So in 98, you sell the RFT for a gajillion dollars.
I did.
True, right. That you wrote every employee a personal check.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we gave a fair amount, but that's no big deal. I think they deserve, you know, we just did, yeah.
Do you remember who Cindy Evans Badamo was?
Badamo, yes, I do. She's still a good friend and was a wonderful, wonderful both person. And she's, I think, gotten out of the business into, I think, counseling or whatever she does now. But Cindy Evans Badamo, one of the, not only the best salespeople, but best people I've ever had work for me.
Apparently you hated the word boss.
I did not. How come? I don't want to be too, you know, I think I treated our employees well and they treated me well. And let's face it. There's been a lot of I in this interview. You don't get where we got because it was like some thing to do with me. A lot of times it was despite me. And sometimes it was because of me. I mean, I did a lot. One of the things I did well, I think, was represent the paper, be the face of the paper. I wasn't the person that really, you know, I got a grief because a lot of times I wouldn't even read the whole thing. You know what I mean? I had great editors, people like Sue Hegger, Julie Lobia, Safira Med. I had some great editors and journalists working for me. And got him Don Patton at the beginning. I mean, I had a lot of really good people work for me. And I was very lucky. I think one of my strengths was hiring good people and letting them. I think I was good at that. I hired good people and stayed out of their hair. Take credit. And my the funny thing is, I had a speech I gave, and I did a lot of public speaking to get the paper up. And it's kind of funny in today's environment to think about it. Because what I said was, our role at the Riverfront Times is to question the assumptions of the mainstream media. That was our existence. Question the assumptions, meaning it wasn't about being liberal so much as we would question their starting assumptions. And I had one I used at every speech. And you know what it was? It was, why should Satan, and I remember, do it by heart. I did it 1,000 times. Why is it, and this is in the heyday of Civic Progress, okay, the organization of top companies. And I said, why is it, one of the assumptions we questioned was, why should 28 rich white guys call all the shots in St. Louis? That was my line. Why should 28 rich white guys call all the shots in St. Louis? Because that's what it was at the time. And I said, and I followed up, I said, can you imagine if 28 young black women of modest means were calling all the shots in St. Louis, would we be fighting about stadiums? That was my first line on every And wherever I went, whether I was at high school or college or giving a lunch speech or wherever it was, I bet I gave that speech 500 times. Using that example, and I think about today now, I'm looking at it thinking, yeah, we're still not talking about people, even with all the stuff going on in the streets, we're still not having a discussion in St. Louis about African-Americans in the business community sitting across the table, eye to eye, looking at white folks. We still don't have that. We've got a couple of successful stories like Dave Stewart and so forth. We still don't have that. And guess, you know who does? Atlanta. They figured this out in the 1970s, that something they call biraciality, which doesn't even exist as a word in St. Louis, made a difference. So yeah, I'm still kind of a, does that make me radical that I think that one of our problems systemically, in addition to the systemic racism that we all are becoming painfully aware of in policing, whatever, I think we should still be talking about that. Does that make me woke? I don't know, because I don't know if it makes me woke or not, because you know what doesn't, what I don't think, is I don't think we ought to be spending a lot of time talking about renaming Del Mar, deciding what statue to tear down. I could care less about whether the street names and renaming St. Louis, all this other, I'm sorry, I just like, I'm not woke like that anymore. But in fact, I never was. I just never believed in, I've been going back and forth with people on Facebook about, you know, what frankly is political correctness. I've never been very politically correct.
And not to pile on, but you buy the STL magazine, walk with me on this one, explain okay. to me why the following opening to a column resonates with you. The column recently starts with, "It is ironic that the Board of Curators feels the need to lock itself into something of a closet to discuss the subject of homosexuality."
I don't remember that one. That would have been the Maneater, right?
So the way the story goes was you wrote that
right.
30 years ago.
Right.
You still got to write it today.
Yeah. Well, interesting. You know, I say, again, this wasn't anything great on my part. I just wasn't raised to be a bigot, you know? I mean, I was in a very conservative household, but I was raised, you know, to believe in integration, not desegregation, integration. I really was raised, even though my father was very conservative, to believe in equality. And, you know, that just was the thing, you know, and certainly never to judge somebody because of their sexual orientation. So it's not like I was the only straight person that felt that way, but gay rights is, you know, we called it, actually the issue, I'll tell you real quickly, as long as you ask, in 73, do you know what the issue was in 1973 that we were fighting about with them?
No, sir.
It was recognition for an organization called Gay Lib. Okay, Gay Lib. And you know what they wanted? They didn't want money. They wanted to be able to meet on campus. That's it. That was recognition meant they could meet on campus. They could go to a campus building at Reed Hall or
Brady Commons?
Yeah, Brady Commons or any of the campus buildings and have a meeting. And of course, the university could not permit such a thing. The university fought this in court, and their argument, and I'm not making this up, this is the state university, the state of Missouri's argument, was that homosexuality was a mental illness and that homosexuals, as they would say, were going to proselytize, that they were going to, not only were they going to spread, they were actually going to turn straight people gay, basically. And that was the argument. And that's not like me being pejorative. That was the argument that they took. And one of the judges who overturned that, who ruled against them, was William Webster, who went on to become the FBI director when he was a judge in Missouri. But not the later William Webster that ran for governor. But really, I mean, that was what we were arguing about back then. That the curators and the state were treating being what we now call LGBTQ as an illness, that and that people who were in that community were trying to recruit the rest of us. I mean, so, you know, that's kind of a layup, I guess. But that was the issue. I'm not making it up. I didn't remember the cob. Sure, that's good that you remembered or found the cob.
Do you still have fun doing Donnybrook?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, we're great. We're really like a family. And
it's a little tricky with Zoom, though, Ray.
Well, I actually personally like it. I don't know that, you know, we've never had like high definition, you know, high level, you know, high tech, you know, design. I think part of the, if you want to call it the charm, has always been this old green table. We've never really, and again, I don't get involved in any production issues. And Channel 9 itself does a great job with it, from Anne-Marie Berger's best director ever. And we, you know, they're great. But I mean, we've never been very formal. I don't mind it at all. And I feel like it works okay. But I mean, you know, after 33 years on the air, it's kind of hard to judge for yourself. When we first started doing it, I was talking about it on the radio, and I thought very cleverly, I referred to it as the Zoom, as sort of a self-deprecating boomer joke. And then about 2 weeks after I called it the Zoom, I'll be darned if really funny people like Kate McKinnon and A.D. O'Brien did a Saturday Night Live skit for the ages that was just hilarious. And one of their, I think it was the first Saturday Night Live at Home thing they did, which I wish they were still doing. And they're getting really up and going, the Zoom, you know, and kind of messed them up, my joke. I called it the Zoom, but I think Zoom works fine. I think you're going to see a lot more companies certainly using it, rather than spending a bunch of money on airfare. And I think it's going to change the world a little bit. I don't know, I'm used to it. I don't have any problem at all with it. And as people know, Bill McClellan is in a high-risk category. He's very openly had a very courageous and, thank God, successful bout with cancer. And we're not in any hurry on his behalf, if nothing else, you know, to take any risks at all. You know, so we're I don't mean to single Bill out, but that's not his point. It's ours, the rest of us. And of course, I'm high risk too, I guess, because I'm old, but not really. But and Bill and I have been together for 33 years as the two of the originals, and obviously we're very dear. But so my point is, we're not in any hurry to stop doing Zoom.
So as we film this podcast and get ready to wrap it up a little bit, it's July 1st. 2020, so if people are hearing this 10 years from now, getting set for the election, I'm not a political person, I'm going to throw you some softballs, right? Sure. July 1st, 2020, how in the world are 15% still undecided?
I don't know if they really, on a national level?
Right.
I don't know if they are. I mean, I guess there's always a certain amount of, you know, in theory, in a perfect world, everybody would be undecided, I guess, until they see all the facts. I mean, at this point, I think, I'd be surprised if that many are actually really undecided between Trump and Biden. I hope not. I mean, of course, I do think this is the most important election of my lifetime. And I know that's kind of almost a cliche, but this isn't a political thing. I do think the future of the democracy is at stake in this election. And it's interesting for me because I probably have as many Republican friends as Democratic friends. I consider myself independent. I'm obviously on the Democratic side of everything and to the left, but I'm not really a fan of the Democratic establishment, national committee and so forth. And I think this is really important for our country because I think the person in the White House is, and this has got nothing to do with liberal conservative politics. I'll tell you what, if you want to, so we don't get too political, the places to go for the best information is a website called thebulwark.com, which is all former Republicans like Bill Kristol, and maybe still Republicans. And then the Lincoln Project is doing the best ads. And I think the Republicans against Trump have been far more persuasive and far more effective than the Democrats have been. And so I happen to be very obviously passionate, but it isn't anti-Republican. I feel like the Republican Party has been hijacked by somebody. I never really stayed with the Republican Party, but I know what it was when it was good. In Missouri, the Republican Party was the Reform Party when I worked for Kit Bond. And It ain't now. So there's that. But I mean, you know, I don't. I say I love the fact that you don't do a lot of politics, Mr. Oliver, because it's nice. Nice break. And even on my KTRS show, I think the most fun I have is doing the show with no name on Friday nights. That's all about comedy and music. When you've been doing this long enough, you know, after 40 years, it's, I don't know. I'd rather do lighter stuff. I just think we're at a pretty crucial time with the pandemic, with the dual pandemics of the police situation and the health situation. This is pretty uncharted water for our country right now.
So ducktailing on that, how come August 4th is so important?
Well, in Missouri, I mean, the main importance I would say is Medicaid expansion, I think, is something that's unfortunately people on the left are spending all their time talking about statues and streets, street names. And I'm not diminishing in any way the importance of what really the largest civil rights movement in history, but almost nobody's talking about Medicaid expansion, which would affect people of color and others, particularly in rural Missouri. All the rural hospitals are closing, and it's horrendous. That's probably the main thing on the August ballot that I think matters. Well, and you know, obviously there's the county executive race, but that's, you know, people have to make their own call on that. I think that the November 3rd election matters greatly, and could be a really interesting year. I have to tell you, this, you know, you think about it. 2020 is a year that will be remembered for its number. Do you know what I'm saying? If you say, what are the years that you kind of remember the number? Well, you got 1776. You got, we'll go through all of them, but more recently, 1929 for the Great Depression, you know, either 63 for the year Kennedy was shot or 64 for the Civil Rights Act, but you might really remember 68. As being one of those years that we talk about, the summer of 68. And then we had maybe 2001 with the World Trade Center tragedy. 2020 has already gone down in history as a year that will be remembered for its number, and it's only half over. You think about it, there have been three or four major cataclysmic stories that would dominate any other decade that we've had in this year. I mean, you remember impeachment? I mean, it's almost like, when was that? That was this year. And then, of course, obviously, the worst pandemic, arguably, in the history of the country and maybe the world. And then, by far and away, the largest civil rights movement and really a sea change in how we think about, very needed sea change in how we police our communities and racial justice. And so you think about it. We've had three, each one of those would have dominated any of the decade, and we've had three of them in the first half of this year. So it's a little hard to predict what's going to happen in the second half.
Wrapping up the political stuff, when it comes to George Floyd and the main officer who killed him,
okay,
that guy better see some time behind bars or this thing's going to blow up.
I guess, he will, I think. But the thing is that,
I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah, I think he will. And he brought people together. I mean, you know, people on the right, you know, were as appalled publicly as people on the left, really. I mean, about his specific case. The problem is, this isn't a one-off. And I know the New York Times recently did something where they found like 70 cases like George Floyd's, except that they weren't on video. And so I think the bigger thing that's got to come out of that horrible murder is not punishment for one guy or four guys. It's really got to be a systemic change in how we look at this. And I think it's happening. Again, people will differ on the details, but I think there's all of a sudden, for the first time ever, if you just go back 6 years to Ferguson, there was great, great pushback from when people said Black Lives Matter for the first time. That phrase never came out until it did in St. Louis in 2014. That was its first utterance, okay, was Black Lives Matter. And immediately the response was, well, all lives matter, or well, blue lives matter. It was great pushback to that. There's no pushback anymore. They never meant to say that nobody else's life matters, but there's no pushback. You don't have to qualify it. And Black Lives Matter went from looking like a terrorist organization to a lot of white people to the fact that the large majority of Americans, when you ask about Black Lives Matter, I think it's in the 60s or 70s, approve of its mission. So we've come a long way. And that doesn't mean we agree on everything. A guy we saw not recently in St. Louis, some very bizarre scenes. You know, what's interesting, I have to say to you, David, is that we went through a period, I remember it, where we were very resentful in St. Louis about how we never got any coverage. I mean, people were, you know, like we were flyover country and everybody's East Coast, West Coast. Nobody gives us our due. It would really be good to go a couple years without being in the national news, you know, because they know that the folks in the national media are just too familiar with like all our hotels and our streets, I'm afraid. We just keep coming up over and over for the wrong reasons in the national news.
So let's talk about something positive.
Yeah.
Promote, take as long as you want, Starkloff Disability Institute.
Well, it's Max Starkloff was possibly one of the great, well, was one of the great St. Louisans of all time and the great people. Max Starkloff was a, whose father, by the way, was involved and had a great role in making sure that St. Louis, you know, completely set the gold standard for how to handle a pandemic and the flu of 1918. Max was a giant of a man, good looking, like 6'6", good looking, great, you know, just living on top of the world, and had a car accident, riding a sports car, it flipped over, and he was rendered he became a quadriplegic. And at the time that happened, I'm not going to call it a tragic accident because Max didn't. He thinks it's the best thing ever happened in his life. And he did a whole thing about, if I could have that day over, would I, you know, if I could take a magic pill. He did if you ever get a chance to Google the magic pill, Max Starkloff, he said, if I could take a magic pill and undo that, would I? He said, absolutely not. Because Max Starkloff, living in as a person with disabilities, a quadriplegic, got himself, after he was left for dead, basically in a nursing home, which is what people did in the late 50s, he got himself out of his nursing home through his own genius and initiative. I mean, he learned to paint with his mouth, and they were amazing artwork he created with his, using just a paintbrush and in his mouth, okay? He was that amazing a person with his wonderful, he met a physical therapist who he went on to marry, one of the great people, Colleen Starkloff. They started Paraquad, and eventually, which was about empowering disabled people to help themselves. Nothing about pity, nothing about help, about independent living for people with disabilities. Max Starkloff was an inspiration for more people, including myself, than anyone I've ever known. Passed away several years ago. Eventually, he left Paraquad and founded the Starkloff Disability Institute, which I served for many years on the board of. And it was, I have to say, it was one of the great honors of my life to know Max Starkloff, much less to serve on his boards at Paraquad and Starkloff Disability Institute. It's just a little organization, but it's, his legacy will live forever. And he did so much to empower people with disabilities. And, you know, that's what I think of that.
Still involved with the Eagle Scouts?
No, I'm not really involved. I am an Eagle Scout, and people used to always try to ask, how could he be an Eagle Scout and a communist? I don't understand. But I'm not actively involved. There's an Eagle Scout Association that my dad was president of. It's a fine organization, but I sort of really haven't stayed actively involved, although, I'm happy that I was. And I will say this, if I can give a shout out to my late father, who was very, very politically conservative. He almost single-handedly and with very little attention set up a camping program back in the 60s at Beaumont Scout Camp, where the Eagle Scout Association ran it, basically. And it was to provide a week, you know, summer camp opportunities for kids from Pruitt-Igoe, basically, mostly from the inner city back then. It was horrible conditions in Pruitt-Igoe, but it was infamous as one of the worst housing projects really in the country. And he set that up again. He just believed in it. And I had the opportunity to spend 3 summers working as a volunteer, not the entire summer, but probably a total of 8 weeks, I'm going to guess, over 3 years. And I'd be the leader, the youth leader. There were Scoutmasters involved, wasn't just my dad, but he organized it. And I was a youth leader. And so the typical troop would be maybe 20, 22 African-American kids, and I was the leader. And I think a lot of my views on, remember, I went to Parkway Central when there was one black kid out of 2,200, okay? I was just a wimpy little white kid from the suburbs. My views today on racial justice were informed by that, because by the end of the week, I knew all 20 of those kids' names. There was probably 200 kids at Beaumont back then. But the only ones I knew out of the 200, other than the camp counselors themselves from Beaumont, which I wasn't one of, I just was involved with this, were the 20 kids that I'd worked with that week. That's it. And it taught me what it felt. I mean, it wasn't any great, black like me moment. The fact is, they were my friend. They were the kids that I knew. Every one of them, by the way, at 11, could kick my butt when I was 16. but frankly, most 11-year-olds, even in the suburbs, could have probably. But the point is, I learned a lot about that. I learned about that. And so that really helped me. And I'm very proud of my dad that he was involved in setting that up, even though it was just something he just believed in. So when you say Eagle Scout Association, the Eagle Scout Association did that back then, and it was a great thing.
You were always prepared.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. but I can still do the Scout Oath. And I do think I was very fortunate to, be taught, good values by my parents.
All right, man. Well, we're going to go run off and do a St. Louis 7. I know this isn't what you typically do, but we got through it, and hopefully you had a good time.
I did. It was great. An honor to be. You told me when you called me that this was – that you use this podcast to talk to important people from St. Louis. And I thought, well, as long as you're going to take a break from that format, you'd have me on. I appreciate it.
And another one for the books. I've got some exciting news. Thanks to you overtimers, I think we're ready for 2 episodes a week. Starting Monday, July 27th, we're going to drop an episode on Monday and on Thursday. Thanks for sharing. Monday's first podcast, JC Corcoran. As we do in honor of the Mr. Jack Buck, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.